reading certain poems or avoiding others depending upon audience, the way Morgan Parker might read her Matt poem at very white colleges, for instance.
Yeah, I was, last AWP, I think, I was in the room and Morgan read that poem at the Tin House reading, and like a lot of white men were in the audience laughing, and she stopped and said, "Why are you laughing? This poem is about you." And I liked that ability to kind of break the fourth wall and step outside oneself was really appealing. I tend to read what I'm going to read. But a better question I ask myself is not, can the audience handle this? It's more, can I handle an audience reaction to this? Because I say that because I'm someone who really enjoys not necessarily the reading, but the interaction after the reading. To me, the reading is kind of perfunctory. Like, me reading my own work is fine and I don't mind it. But the reading is kind of a vehicle to get to talk to people after the reading, be it in a Q&A, which, you know, I'm perhaps the rare writer who enjoys a Q&A, which, of course, there's some privilege involved in that. I think the type of things I write and the fact that I am a man and a straight man, and I think that I get different sets of questions than some of my peers might get. And so there's kind of a privilege to my ability to not be terrified or turned off entirely by a Q&A. But I want to offer that, like, I want to offer like an immersive Q&A experience. I love, I like signing books and talking to people. You know, I like talking to people about their music scenes or what sports they came up playing, like the things that I'm interested in that I didn't ever think I would have a wide enough venue to talk to people about these things. You know, like, obviously, yes, I could talk to music about strangers on the internet, which I did. I came up like in message boards talking about records and stuff, but I didn't think that this would be a thing I could do. So I think about that, and I think about those interactions that I can handle. In my new book, there's like a really long, maybe like 6,000 word piece on blackface, and there are audiences. I like that piece. I like reading it. But there are days where I look at an audience and I tell myself, okay, I maybe can't handle talking about this piece to this audience for 30 minutes after this is over. And it's not, that is not an indictment on the audience itself. But I also think that I'm a firm believer in the fact that the people who I'm writing my work for, the work will reach them, and everyone else can have access to it, but I'm not going to explain things. You know, I have a piece on spades in my new book, and you know, every time I read it, I always tell people, like, this piece doesn't explain the playing of spades. If you know how to play spades, you're going to get it. If not, then you're going to find your way into this piece through some other door, hopefully. But I think some of that is just like a hopeful, training is a hard word. I don't want to use the word training, but a readjustment of an audience's expectation that they should have the same entry point access as everyone in the room. If I am interested in writing multi-layered work, that means I'm interested in offering the widest door possible to the people I'm writing for, my people, the people who understand where I'm coming from. But that also means that there's another entry point to a piece about spades where you might be able to sneak in through a smaller door and still feel something. And so if I do have some discomfort in places, which doesn't, I want to say it doesn't happen often. I mean, like, most of the rooms I'm in, to be frank, just have a lot of black folks in them. But audiences, as they've expanded, I mean, I think that, or at the very least have some black folks in them, and audiences, as they expanded, depending on the city, that might not look the same, but I've just traveled so much and I've kind of just gotten used to maneuvering this world. But what I'm most invested in is reading the work that I feel good about on that day, because I don't know if other writers deal with this, but there are days where I don't feel good about the stuff that I would normally read. When I was coming up, I came up in slam, and I would do like I saw a lot of my peers doing, where I would just have like a set list ready to go. I would have a set list that I would perform everywhere. some of that is because I didn't have much else. I didn't have a ton of work to cycle through. But other parts of that was because I just knew what people wanted to hear. And there was something about, you know, and I still, you know, I'll still read at a slam every now and then because I love the environment and I love, like, the, I don't ever want to stray from that, my roots in slam, because that's how I learned how to read work. That's how I learned how to read audiences. That's how I learned what parts of my work could get responses, right? And so I still read a slam every now and then, a couple, you know, if they'll have me. And I still know, you know, when I pull up, I'm like, I know what I can read here. I'm never more confident as a reader than I am in those rooms, right? But in every other room, there are times where I just don't feel good about my work. And so the goal is always to read what I feel good about.
Could you introduce this to and read It Is an Entirely Different Thing to Walk Into the River with Stones?
Yeah, this is a piece that actually came out of my curiosity about Mary Clayton, which there's a Mary Clayton essay in my new book. And when I was writing it, I wrote this piece. You know, this piece was going to be a part of that essay, or at least the ideas around this piece were going to be a part of that essay. But then I kind of extracted it and made it into this poem. And
could you orient us to, or to listeners who don't know who Mary Clayton is, and maybe the story that you're referencing?
Yeah, Mary Clayton. Most people probably know Mary Clayton, but don't know Mary Clayton. Mary Clayton sang in the background on the Rolling Stones song "Give Me Shelter." It's almost unfair to say she sang in the background. She really overwhelmed the song. She took over that song so that it became her song. Shortly after leaving the studio where she sang in that song, she went home and miscarried the child she was carrying when she went in the studio. You know, she was maybe 7 months pregnant. And the story of the background singer, particularly the black woman background singer, not just Mary Clayton, but a host of them, is fascinating to me because so many white bands came to America, so many white bands from, like, not America, and even some who were from America, were looking to capture a blues sound. And in order to do that, they would cycle through, you know, black women vocalists as background singers and really wring all they could out of them. And those women never really get the credit I think they deserve. And Mary Clayton is among the most tragic of those stories. She is still living, but she, a couple years ago, got into a really bad car accident and had to have her legs amputated. And that was another, you know, when I think I began working on the essay when I heard that story, because I was just grieving that. And so this is the poem, It Is an Entirely Different Thing to Walk Into the River with Stones. Stretching the fabric of pockets stitched onto a black overcoat. It may seem like now is not the time, but shout out to the Stones, whom the old lovers would drop a needle on the first morning they woke to find out their beloved had run into the arms of another. Shout out to the snaps that firework and flourish from a record's ridges in the silence before a song starts. An animal, running its claws against the bars of a prison long enough, grows to love the sound more than it loves freedom. Mick Jagger got a pregnant Mary Clayton out of bed at midnight because he needed someone to sing the word murder like they were trying to squeeze it through a barbed wire fence without opening a wound on their own fingers. And Mary Clayton got home from the studio and miscarried. And when her voice tears at the air on the second syllable of murder, Jagger whispers, "Wow." And the song must hold up despite death. And it must still be able to sell a car or a sandwich or a war, no matter how many grains of sand it kicked down the tunnel of the hourglass. And it must be able to play in a market where two people trace entire futures out of each other with a cascade of stolen glances. What backstory? What suffering are you willing to make your soundtrack while pulling a zipper south or hiding a condom inside of a hotel Bible? Shout out never to my sins themselves, but always to the child they made me when I was consumed by them. Shout out to the names of boys I wished were never born, and how I've held each name in my pocket and walked to the water's edge.
We're listening today to Hanif Abdurraqib read from A Fortune for Your Disaster. I guess I think that was what I was reaching toward in my question earlier about the cost for a white performer or magician versus a black performer or musician, in the sense that when David Bowie asks Hugh Jackman if he's considered the cost of the machine that will cause astonishment but kill a part of himself, it feels like instead of a part of someone being killed, in the case of white performers, that cost is being offloaded on someone else. When you talk about this accumulating group of black backup singers that never get credit, and the clones at the end of the movie,
right,
that make the magic trick so amazing, but obviously the clones aren't being seen as integral to the trick, even though they really are.
I mean, even zooming out, right? I think what I am learning in this real time is that America, well, not even learning, but what I am readjusting myself to understanding is that America itself is the magic trick, right? America itself is the magic trick, and the people who actually do the work to make the trick appear what it is are not the people who get to take a bow, right? That was the whole thing with The Prestige. That was the whole thing with Angier, with Hugh Jackman's character, was that he just wanted to be present. He didn't want to disappear below the stage while a doppelganger took a bow. Like, he didn't want to drop below the stage and have some random person who he dressed up to look like him drink in the applause of the audience. He wanted to be the person who got to, even a clone of himself, even a just born 5-minute living clone of himself, wanted to take in that applause of the audience, right? And I think that's the whole thing. America itself is the magic trick, and the people taking the bow are not the people who are working to hold up the facade of what people have thought this country is for a long time.
Yeah. Well, I want to pivot to a couple questions around craft, because this poem is the first poem you've read that is a prose block. But a lot of your poems are written in this style. And you've said that in the first 2 years of writing poetry, you wrote entirely with performance in mind and didn't yet have a relationship to the line or to line breaks, and thus wrote with prose blocks. Can you talk to us more about this, how you develop your style using prose poems, and then how you later then learned to have a relationship to the line that's different than the prose block poems?
Yeah, I mean, I most of my first book is prose blocks too. You know, I like the conversational nature of a prose block, because, and truthfully, my first couple of years I was writing solely for the stage and not thinking about how the poems would look on the page beyond that. I was writing to memorize, and there was something about prose block that helped me memorize. It took me back to perhaps, you know, I was in drama club in high school, and so it took me back to memorizing monologues, large blocks of text that I could just read and kind of store. And so I was writing in prose blocks because, one, that's the way I wrote, and I wasn't writing for them to appear anywhere other than in on a piece of paper I'd memorized, too, because it was a tool of memorization. And so, and truthfully, I think the prose block became my form because I think there's an underrated musicality in a well-structured prose block. If you are to use ampersands, or if you are to use no punctuation at all, I also grew up on punk scenes, and I love a short, fast, and loud song. And I think a prose block with no punctuation is kind of like the short, fast, loud song of poetry, you know? It's kind of breathless, it chugs along at an impossible pace, and then it removes you from it. And with that in mind, particularly with this book, I think the evolution between, if there is a large evolution between The Crown Ain't Worth Much and A Fortune for Your Disaster, it's in that I became very interested in the musicality of space, like physical space on the page. I began to think of arranging lines of a poem like arranging an orchestra, and were arranging different musical sections and different beats, and I got really fascinated in the moving around of language and what space could offer. And so all my poems still begin in prose blocks. I still write everything, first draft is a prose block. And then I begin to, and I'm also a very audio driven person. I read all my poems out loud and record myself reading them in the first draft and then play them back to myself. Because I think in the process of doing that, the poem tells you how it wants to be read. It tells you, for me, in my case, in my brain, it tells me what genre of music it is. It tells me if it's a jazz arrangement or an R&B ballad or a punk song. It tells me all of these things in the reading of it. And through that reading of it, I think I make my formal decisions in terms of, am I going to go short couplets? Am I going to go, you know, massively spread out language on the page that gives people a lot of room to breathe and work through really slowly? All these are decisions I make based off of sound.
You were writing a column at the Paris Review, and in one of them you were talking about giving a craft talk on poetry and sound, and you say, the point is about silence, I think, or the point I'm trying to make is about how the voice itself isn't the instrument, that language is the instrument and voice is just the vehicle, like a speaker or an amplifier. The point is about silence and the things we deem as percussion, how along the landscape of silence, any sound that interrupts can be percussive. I guess I wondered, in light of that, if sometimes in your prose blocks we see the slashes instead of lines.
Right, yeah.
Is that for you the silence that you're talking about there?
Yeah. Yeah, and in a way it's percussive, right? It's an interruption. It's also me saying, it's a gentle ask for someone to slow down. Like, if I don't want to take a poem out of a prose block, if I'm telling myself this poem works best in a prose block, but I want you to slow down from time to time, I'm putting those slashes in there as a gentle ask, right? If I want line breaks but still want the prose block, I'll put those slashes in and I'll nestle the words the collection of words that I think are best within those slashes. And I don't know. I started doing that mostly because, you know, my first book, it was an evolution for me, where I'd have all these prose block poems and I was trying to learn to do line breaks, and I was like, well, the way I'll do this is by putting these slashes in here and then I'll break the lines. Like, I'm putting these slashes in here as an experiment to tell myself when to break and where. But then I did it a couple times. I was like, oh, actually, this looks good. This works as it is. I want to keep it. And so that's how that came about.
Let's hear another prose block poem and then a poem that's more traditionally in lines. If we could hear it, it is maybe time to admit that Michael Jordan definitely pushed off, and then if life is as short as our ancestors insist it is, why isn't everything I want already at my feet?
Sure. It is maybe time to admit that Michael Jordan definitely pushed off. That one time in the 98 NBA Finals, and in praise of one man's hand on the waist of another's, and in praise of the ways we guide our ships to the shore of some brief and gilded mercy, I touch my fingers to the hips of this vast and immovable grief and push once more. And who is to say, really, how much weight was behind Jordan's palm on that night in Utah? And on that same night, 1 year earlier, the paramedics pulled my drowning mother from the sheets where she slept, and they said it must have felt like a whole hand was pushing down on her lungs. And I spent the whole summer holding my breath in bed until the small black spots danced on the ceiling. And I am sorry that there is no way to describe this that is not about agony, or that is not about someone being torn from the perch of their comfort. And on the same night, a year before my mother died, Jordan wept on the floor of the United Center locker room after winning another title because it was Father's Day, and his father went to sleep on the side of a road in 93 and woke up a ghost, and there is no moment worth falling to our knees and galloping toward like the one that sings our dead back into the architecture. And so, yes, For a moment in 1998, Michael Jordan made what space he could on the path between him and his father's small and breathing grace. And so, yes, there is an ocean between us, the length of my arm, and I have built nothing for you that can survive it. And from here, I am close enough to be seen, but not close enough to be cherished. And from here, I can see every possible ending before we even touch. If life is as short as our ancestors insist it is, why isn't everything I want already at my feet? If I make it to heaven, I will ask for all the small pleasures I could have had on earth, and I'm sure this will upset the divine order. I'm a simple man. I want mostly a year that will not kill me when it is over, a hot stove and a wooden porch bent under the weight of my people. I was born, and it only got worse from there. In the dead chill of a doctor's office, I am told what to cut back on and what to add more of. None of this sounds like living. I sit in a running car underneath a bath of orange light and eat the fried chicken that I swore an oath to stray from for the sake of my heart and its blood labor. Still, there is something about the way a grease stain begins small and then tiptoes its way along the fabric of my pants. Here, finally, a country worth living in. One that falls thick from whatever it is we love so much that we can't stop letting it kill us. If we must die, let it be inside here. If we must.
We're listening today to Nif Abdurraqib read from A Fortune for Your Disaster. We talked a little bit about literal audiences, but I was curious a little bit about imagined audiences. When I think about Michael Jordan creating the creation of space by that arm, and then thinking about a lot of your writing about being in white spaces, whether that be at punk shows or at a Bruce Springsteen concert where you're one of the only, if not the only, person of color there, or playing soccer for Capital University as the only black player and the first American-born black player in school history, and just the presence in general of the audience and the effect of the audience when you're writing about music. I wondered about not so much the literal audience, but also about whether you write toward a specific audience, if whether you're creating a space, imagined or real, that you're writing toward or for.
Mostly I'm writing for the people I grew up around, the people in my neighborhood, which is, you know, I think where I'm from on the east side of Columbus shows up a lot of my work, and it shows up a lot of my work without explanation. And the street names and the parks and all these things show up without explanation, because I think that I am kind of writing towards a place where the people I grew up around can see a part of their experience reflected in my work, a part of our shared experience reflected in my work. An honoring of the place we're from and an honoring of the people we knew showing up in my work. And so that is my main interest, I think. I mean, I grew up in two different largely black areas on the east side of Columbus, and those areas had people who were varied and unique and with vastly different interests and investments in the world. And I think I learned from all of them. And so I really want to honor them. And I think that is the audience that I'm thinking of first and foremost.
Well, one way to look at magic tricks is as this means to produce a sense of wonder or amazement. But another way is looking at the tricks as deceptions. And the way the book is bookended foregrounds this latter aspect. The collection is bookended by the lines from the character played by Michael Caine in The Prestige, a story he's telling that he ultimately admits isn't true. And similarly, the collection is bookended by poems entitled The Prestige. But the final poem entitled The Prestige has two versions, a more hopeful version, an erasure of the same poem that is much more hopeless and dark. And perhaps like the Michael Caine story, one is a lie and one is the truth. Perhaps one is the duplicate that must die so that the other can astonish, but we don't know which one is which.
Yeah.
I wanted you to talk about your desire to land here tonally and thematically at the end in this doubling space.
Yeah, I mean, I do want to say that the, you know, initially I had the book opening on a black page with the story of the sailor, but I took it away because I liked kind of presenting the conclusion of that at the ending, and just have it hanging there, and I think largely this is because of how I felt after I wrote the book. I mean, after I wrote this book and was finished with it, I felt exhausted in a way that I had never felt before when completing a project. I had felt so emotionally drained. I felt like I had reached the top of this emotional mountain and I had to kind of figure out, okay, how am I going to get back? How am I going to get back down? And it appeared to me then, as it still does now, that that was the hard part. The hard part wasn't the writing. The hard part was returning to a sense of emotional normalcy after the writing. And that part was difficult. And that part felt more like a challenge. And so, you know, I love that story and how it appears in the movie, because it's like Cutter, Michael Caine's character, clearly tells it to Angier to say, what you're embarking on is going to feel easy. And then you get to the end and it's like, actually, what you're about to embark on is the hard part. And so I love that there. In the ending Prestige, I wanted to play with the trick of making it something that had vanished reappear. And so I wrote like this reverse erasure. And I wanted to land on that idea of what it is to make the language reappear after it had gone away, and to present a fuller picture of what I wanted the ending to be after, you know, making the ending seem really sparse and somewhat bleak.
Before we end, I wanted to hear about your upcoming two books. You have a two book deal.
Just one now. Yeah.
Oh, is it just one?
Yeah, we cut it to just one.
Okay. And is that the book on black performance in the US?
Yeah, it is. And that will be out in about a year from now. It's done. I turned it in. And we're doing like final edits and doing cover stuff right now, which is exciting. You know, this is the first year I've had since 2015 where I'm not spending the year working on a book or spending the year working on a book project. And that's really freeing. And so I'm excited about this book. It's a collection of really like much longer essays that are honing in on celebrations of performers and performance, be it Josephine Baker or the playing of spades or Ellen Armstrong, who's the first black woman magician to have her own show, or Dave Chappelle. I'm just like considering how performance sits in the world, black performance sits in the world, and how it's consumed by the world.
Maybe the final question would be, looking at this book and the writing of it in relationship to your books as a whole, because I know when you write about bands, you often love to write it not about a band's most famous record, but often the one that follows it. So the way that Fleetwood Mac followed Rumours with Tusk,
right,
which challenged their audience and even antagonized their audience rather than giving them what they wanted after a very successful thing. And your book, Go Ahead in the Rain, was such a huge success and was a finalist for many huge awards, a bestseller. And you said that the appreciation and success actually made you second guess what's happening in the book, that maybe you had cast too wide a net. And it just made me wonder, under what sort of miasm you were writing psychologically when you were writing the next book, because you're very curious about what a band does when they're writing under the shadow of a previous success. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like writing in either an anticipated or unanticipated success with Go Ahead in the Rain, and how that would color or not color the writing of your upcoming book?
Oh, it doesn't color it at all. I mean, my approach stays the same. Yeah, my approach is almost always the same. And the approach for this book is I think most similar to Go Ahead in the Rain, in that it was asking, how can I tell a unique and exciting run of stories that aren't just about a person living and dying, but honoring the entire landscape that they touched, and thinking about how that landscape involves my life or the lives of people I love. I mean, I have a piece about Soul Train Lines that is also a piece about my friends and my parents and the people I watched dancing on WGN on Sundays when they show reruns when I was a kid. And I mean, so it's a similar approach. I take the same approach. I'm not, you know, I think part of that is because literary quote unquote success is so arbitrary that it's not even something I think about or can consider. It'd be unfair for my work if I were to consider that. You know, I'm beholden to the work first. I believe in doing the work the best way I can at the moment with the tools I have, and whatever comes out of that comes out of that.
Well, I love the collection, Hanif, and I'm really happy we were able to, after many hurdles, have this conversation about it.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time.
We're talking today to Hanif Abdurraqib about his latest collection from Tin House, A Fortune for Your Disaster. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO is hiring a data coordinator. Our data coordinator supports KBOO's fundraising activities by organizing donor information, tabulating contributions and campaign totals, and maintains KBOO's database. Experience